There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We're trying to speak the truth on the issues of the day, real issues in real time. That's what we're trying to equip you to do. How are you going to speak the truth today on the matters that confront you and your neighbors, your colleagues, and your friends? And how are you going to do that in a way that honors Jesus? That's our goal, to help you, to equip you, to get God back into the conversations of the day in order that that conversation might change, in order that the eternal principles might be brought to bear in the thinking of another person. I mean, if you could just get people thinking about what they're thinking about today, you will have lived the day well. So I think that we are at the stage of the game where people do not need just another opinion piece. They don't need just a piece of my mind, but they do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. Jesus is the Prince of Peace, and that surpasses all understanding. So how do we resist giving people a piece of our mind? And instead, how do we actually influence the conversation in such a way that people depart from a conversation with us with the very peace of the mind of Christ? I mean, wouldn't that be a great day? Wouldn't that be a day well spent? At the end of the day, you'd be able to lay your head down on the pillow and say, you know what? I actually accomplished something. I got God back into that conversation in a way that honored Jesus. If you want some help with that, we've got resources posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, sign up for our email newsletter. Through that, we will send you all kinds of information and commentary that we simply don't have time to share here in the hour on the air. We'd appreciate it if you'd go to Facebook and like our page, The Reconnect with Carmen. Let us know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter a lot. So if you want to interact with me, Twitter's a great place to do that. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends. The headline news pretty much everywhere today, other than we've got Senate confirmation hearings ongoing for the new director of the FBI. But the other big headline news, or the headline news, has really been dominating the news for a couple of days now, is that over the weekend, the New York Times published a story that they have been working on since for probably the better part of a year. It's related to a June 2016 meeting between a Russian lawyer and a member of Donald Trump's family, who was also a member of Donald Trump's campaign. So this happened right after Donald Trump won Indiana and became the presumptive nominee. Donald Trump Jr. was contacted by a Russian lawyer who we would acknowledge did not work in any official capacity for the Kremlin, but did represent some very powerful people in Russia. So if you were contacted via email by a Russian lawyer and the offer was for a meetup, and in the email, I mean, the suggestion was very openly and overtly made that there was an interest, the Russians had an interest in helping your dad be elected to a particular position. Okay, probably the prudent thing to do is to pass that information along to, let's say, the FBI or somebody else who might help you answer that in such a way that would keep you out of hot water. Well, you know, this is the world of politics and intrigue and Miss Universe and all kinds of other reality TV things that are going on seemingly in the life of our country. So instead, what happened is that the meeting, in fact, took place. Now, the meeting, initially, the problem here is that they tried to cover up that there was a meeting. So the initial response by Donald Trump Jr., his initial response is frankly intentionally misleading. He claimed that the meeting was held in relationship to the Russian government's suspension of American adoptions. Now, we have talked about the suspension of American adoptions in Russia. We've talked about the trauma that that is for the families involved, and we have talked about the ongoing concern that we have for children in that circumstance. And so that's a real issue, and that would have been a substantive reason for people to get together, but ultimately that's not what the meeting was about. Russian sanctions were discussed, but even that is not why the meeting was convened. So finally, the real story came out. The New York Times actually had the emails leading up to the meeting. And there was an email to Trump Jr. showing the request for the meeting and the purpose for it. And the purpose for it was the promise of damaging information on Hillary Clinton. Okay, so is it criminal? We don't yet know. Is it a lie? Is it intentionally deceptive? Certainly. On the spectrum of truth, we are a long way from the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. And we're going to be people of truth. We're going to be the truth people, right? As Christians, we're the truth people. We care about knowing the truth. We care about being liberated by the truth. And we're concerned about telling the truth, being truth tellers. Now, we want to tell the truth in love. We certainly want to speak the truth in love. That's the biblical mandate. But the reality here is you gotta get yourself aligned with the truth wherever the truth is and wherever the truth leads. Okay? So the second thing of concern here might be the lack of any remorse whatsoever. So it certainly appears in his media appearances in the last 24 hours that Donald Trump Jr. does not have any sense of shame or remorse over his actions. He seems to believe that because the lawyer ultimately didn't have any dirt to share, that this whole conversation should just go away. But ultimately, that's not the issue. The issue is not so much legal as it is moral. The concern is not whether or not this is criminal, but whether or not this is right and righteous. And so when we talk about an individual's conduct and we talk about whether or not, you know, there was actual collusion to in some way disrupt the American election, we have no idea whether or not any of that is going to come to anything. What we do know is that we have an individual who seems to have a very distant relationship with the truth. And so we as people of truth, we just need to step into these conversations in a way that honors the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And yes, we will need God's help to do that. I think it's important that we recognize that, you know, ultimately the truth comes to light. When deeds are done in darkness, they are ultimately exposed by the light. And also, you know, when we're under pressure, that's actually when it's revealed who we really are. So when you see the response, either by the president or by his son or by others involved in this, when you see their response and their reactions, this is a lot of pressure. And so how a person responds under pressure is often a very good indication of what they're full of. All right. So as a Christian, I want to be a person who is full of the truth. I want to be full of grace and truth, right? This is what Jesus is full of. And so as a Christian, when life squeezes me, it would be great if truth and grace would come out. Now, that doesn't always happen. I certainly fall short. I'm not there yet. But that is the way that I want to be pursuing sanctification in my own life. All right. I am thrilled to have on the line with me right now our friend, Steve Arterburn. He is here to discuss with us Every Man's Battle, which is a workshop that's happening this weekend in Jacksonville, Florida. So particularly if you are in our listening area in WAVA in the greater Orlando area, you are in easy driving distance of the New Life Ministries Every Man's Battle workshop this weekend in Jacksonville. Steve is the founder and chairman of New Life Ministries. He's the host of nationally syndicated Christian counseling talk show called New Life Live, heard and watched by more than 3 million people every day. We have talked to him before about books that he has written and things that he's involved in, but today we're going to talk about Every Man's Battle, the workshop in Jacksonville. Steve, welcome back to the Reconnect.
Hey, thanks for having me back. You know, it rarely happens. Anybody asks me to come back, so it's a good thing.
Hey, we're not just a boomerang. We're like a merry-go-round, so you just come back anytime.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
So what is Every Man's Battle, and how does this weekend's workshop in Jacksonville address those issues?
Well, the book was published 17 years ago, and it was talking about mainly the lust problem that men have that was beginning to manifest itself in just an epidemic of guys that are using pornography and not really talking about it, not doing anything about it. Fortunately, all these years later, We've got a lot of people that have done something about it, and they found reclaimed their integrity as a man, as a Christian man, and it's been great to be a part of that. And this weekend, we're going to do it again. We're going to help some guys find that thing that they've given up, and you know, pornography has just taken over their life, and we want to help them get their life back, have the credibility and integrity that they had, reconnect with their wife, or become a man that would be worthy of a good marriage if that were to be in their future.
Okay, so we do not often hear this issue addressed from the pulpit. Churches do not often address the topic of pornography addiction, but you say this is literally every man's battle, and this is actually a big concern for Christian men. So just speak to the Christians in the audience right now who may not have ever admitted that this is really an issue, and get them turned toward the Every Man's Battle Conference.
Well, you know, the reality is every man has to decide what he's going to do. Is he going to look at this stuff? Is he going to participate in it or not? And when you're involved in pornography, it's an act of betrayal, and it breaks connection, and then you've got this shame associated with it, even if you don't acknowledge it right off the bat. You know, it's there. And so you end up in a situation, like if you're married, it's like you're a little boy looking at dirty pictures and being ashamed of that. And then when people have an experience with pornography, they become bonded to that pornography, and your wife becomes a threat to the thing you're bonded to. And so she becomes the enemy. And it's like the angry mom and a dirty little boy looking at dirty pictures. That's not the kind of dynamic that's going to build a marriage or build intimacy. So when you start to take care of this, you start to grow up, you start to become a man, and when you do the responsible thing, I think God really honors that, especially in this world where it is such a prevalent problem.
All right, Steve, so what type of change could really happen in 3 days?
Well, we've seen people go from, I don't have a problem, to, ooh, the problem actually seems to have me, and leave committed to go back home, reconnect or connect for the first time with some men in a support group, to get involved in even some addiction groups like Sex Addicts Anonymous, things like that. But they start to work a program rather than just pray it'll go away and then it doesn't, be frustrated or tell somebody they're going to do better. They actually take action. They get involved and they do something, and then that, over time, produces the character change. But what we do on the weekend is we change the course of their lives. We change the trajectory. We give them hope that you can change this. A lot of guys are thinking, well, this is all I have. I can't live without it. Like an alcoholic thinking, I can't do without this alcoholism. It's all I've got. And we help them see it's not all that you have. You can be victorious. And when you start to do that, all those things that you've lost start to fall back in place one by one. That's why we have so many of our supporters at New Life are people that went through every man's battle. And the change was so dramatic, they wanted to help New Life help other people. That's a big part of our support here, because the change is truly profound. You're headed one way, and then within 48 hours, you're going a different direction. And 75% of the men that come, it's the woman that made the first phone call and finds out about it and then tells him, you need to call these people and you need to go to this thing.
Amen. All right, friends, you can go to the website, newlife.com/workshops/everymansbattle, or in your Google search engine, you can just put Every Man's Battle Workshop. It's in Jacksonville this weekend, July 14 to 16. Steve Arterman will be there to welcome you, to greet you, to encourage you, and to get you turned away from pornography and headed in the right direction, out of bondage, out of shame, into a restored connection, not only with your wife, but, you know, but frankly, with your Savior. So take back your life.
Amen.
This weekend, Every Man's Battle Workshop. Steve, thank you for being with us again here on the Reconnect.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for what you do.
Thanks. All right, friends, what is going on out there in our culture that that you're concerned about? I mean, that's one of the questions that's always in front of me when I am putting the show together for a day, for a particular day. And I got an email from, I don't know if they're a listener, but they're a friend, who lives in the greater Boston area. And she sent me this story about story time at the public library. And I thought, oh, this is going to be so lovely. This is going to be such a great little story. Story time at the public library. How could that be a bad thing? How could there be a culture war going on that we need to engage in during story time at the public library? Oh, and then I read the story. Okay, so hold on to your hat here. This is a story you're going to wish were fiction, but in fact, it is not. So the Boston Public Library concluded its Pride Month celebrations on June the 29th with the Drag Queen Storytime event, during which members of the Boston Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, who, by the way, had been to Storytime before at the Boston Public Library, reading books to children between the ages of 2 and 10 while dressed in mockery of Catholic nuns and touting, well, they have a slogan mocking John chapter 8, verse 11, go forth and sin no more, because they their slogan is go forth and sin more. So that is the group of people who was reading books to little children ages 2 to 10 at the Boston Public Library on June the 29th, dressed up not only as drag queens, but in mockery of Catholic nuns. Now, in response to this, our friend Robert George, who is a professor at Princeton University, he has been, you know, very publicly condemning this, the hosting of this drag queen story time event for young children. He is arguing that this is tantamount to a catechism class, an indoctrination session into the religion of sexual liberation. It should not have been hosted by a government institution. And he goes on to talk about the fact that, look, if any group were making fun of anybody other than Christians, I mean, imagine that this mockery were aimed at immigrants, or if this mockery were aimed at African Americans or Asians, Latinos, handicapped people, Buddhists, Muslims, on and on and on. What if the mockery had actually instead targeted lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender people? There would be outrage across the secular media. There would be outrage across the culture, and rightly so. We don't openly mock and make fun of people using government dollars and using government institutions in our culture. That is just not how we operate as a people, unless you are the Boston Public Library. And so if you want to check out more of this, CBN has a story posted on this about story time with drag queens at the Boston Public Library. I have posted it about it on Twitter. Campus Reform is following it as well. Why do I lift it up as a point of concern? Well, because, you know, the library used to be a safe space. And let's just say that the library is not a safe space if you are a person who believes that people are made intentionally in the image of God, on purpose and for a purpose, and that identity is a core issue that's at stake here in our culture, and that children from the ages of 2 to 10 are malleable, they're teachable, and they can be molded and therefore warped, frankly, into conformity with whatever mold you put them in. And so if you drop your kids off at the public library for story time, you better know who the public library has lined up to read the books and what books they're reading, and you better have read them in advance. Because in my view, the public library is now, as of this act by the Boston Public Library, no longer just a safe place to send your kids for story time in the summer. Okay, next up, I have a story for us out of, this one will lift your spirits. Don't worry. I know, every once in a while, I say things that are just so devastating, and then you say, well, how are we going to recover from that? Well, here you go. This is a story out of Australia. The Australia Broadcasting Corporation posted this story, and it is about a child whose name is Shante. And the reason that I want you to know her story is because the things that her mother shares in this testimony are significant in terms of the larger conversations that we're having in the culture about people with disabilities, particularly about how it is that we remain committed in our culture to children who maybe have profound disabilities, and therefore, you know, frankly, they become a drain. They become a drain on the medical system. They become a drain on their parents. They become a drain on the educational systems. They become a drain on us, right? Well, this mother is helping us to see beyond all of that, beyond all of the things that we might view as difficult related to having a person like Shante in our lives. And she helps us see the beauty and the gospel in the life of another person. Shante is not your average disabled child. She is profoundly disabled. She has a unique spectrum of disabilities. In fact, the medical fraternity in Australia had actually never seen one person who had this number of multiple congenital defects and disorders. She was born blind with cerebral palsy, epilepsy, severe sleep apnea, global developmental delay, respiratory, heart, kidney, bladder, digestive, and other internal organ abnormalities. The fact that this child survived her birth in March of 2003, survived 17 subsequent surgeries and hundreds of stays in the hospital, and lived until May 27th of 2014, when she died of complications related to respiratory pneumonia, is really nothing short of miraculous. And so when we talk about the miracle of an individual's life, we talk about the miracle of a child, we talk about all that a child brings to us in terms of our life experience. Some of the things that this mother talks about in relationship to Shante are really, I think, important. And a huge part of it is the fact that we as people don't often see people with disabilities as people. We see them as disabilities. And I think that if I have any takeaway from this, and I have many, but if I have any takeaway from this, it's this pain that is experienced both by the mother and the child, and I'll quote here from the article, when people would just stare at her, barely containing their distaste. Older women would purse their lips and shake their heads, scolding me for taking care of Shante in ways that they did not understand. She talks in here about the ways in which people would talk about Shante in front of her as if she couldn't hear, as if she couldn't understand what was being said about her. And then she talks about the ways in which she and her child hopefully lived publicly in front of other people, not as a disability, but as a person. Helping people see Shante not as a disability, but to see Shante as a person. And she says here, it's really about the little things. She talks about packing multiple sets of clothing and a willingness to continue to change her child because she would also often lose control of her bodily functions. And she wanted her to have the dignity and the beauty of a person in the world with all the dignity of who she is as a person. And she talks about in here encouraging curiosity, actually encouraging children in particular to ask questions. She says, children ask the most confronting questions, but then they accept your answers wholeheartedly. And so she was using those as opportunities to hopefully open up the conversation in the minds of the next generation related to people with disabilities. She says it's the little things. And so she says, I feel like we were a case study for pediatric people. And she talks in this article about transforming the way that one physician in particular saw her child. And she did it through trying to help this doctor understand that she did not experience her child as a burden. She experienced her child as a blessing. The burdens that were brought into life because of the consequences of the fall. And over time, the consequences of the fall are many, and they manifest themselves in a diversity of ways in our physical lives. But the child herself, Shante, was a gift of God, and she received her as a blessing. And we do not begrudge God the blessings he sends, even when they're in the form of rain, or even when they are in the form of tragedy, or even when they are in the form of things we frankly do not understand. Sometimes the blessings of God come in forms and in shapes that are misaligned with what we think is normal. But we can learn a lot. We can learn a lot about God and about ourselves and about grace through all of that. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the religious right with Richard Land. We'll be right back. Reconnect. Welcome back. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We are seeking to put God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. We're talking about what people are talking about. We're seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We certainly invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You could like us on Facebook. You can let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. Okay, so yesterday in a day-long meeting in the White House, some 30 folks were invited. I will describe them as the way they're described here in the Washington Post as evangelical leaders. They met with President Trump. They prayed with him in the Oval Office. They met in day-long meetings with other folks in the White House around a host of issues. And it probably raises the concern among a lot of people about the resurgence of the religious right. So that led me to this interview that I did with Richard Land a couple of months ago. Richard Land is the president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. He serves as the executive director of the Christian Post. And he's a guy who hasn't just edited, you know, like more than 15 books and has a doctor of philosophy and all these good things. He formerly served as the president of the ERLC, which is the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. You can, if you want to check out what he's doing now, you need to go to ses.edu. That's Southern Evangelical Seminary. But Dr. Richard Land was certainly a part of what we would all recognize as the religious right. So here's my conversation with Dr. Richard Land from a couple of months ago. Dr. Land, welcome to the Reconnect.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
It's a great privilege to have you here with us. Let's start with a conversation about how it is in a post-truth and in very many cases a post-church culture. How do we witness to who Jesus is?
Well, I think we have to go to the evidence, and we have to be completely honest, and we need to answer people's honest questions. We can't assume the things we could assume even when I was in college. You know, I was in college back in the 60s, and there was a tremendous battle and struggle over what the truth was, but we still agreed that there was a truth. Now, we've just been engulfed and submerged by moral relativism. So that, you know, what you hear all the time is, well, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. And we don't even, 70% of our people don't believe there is such a thing as absolute truth. Well, that's moral and ethical suicide. And what it does is it atomizes us. Instead of, the John Donne's poem, No Man's an Island, We're All Part of the Whole. Well, in a moral relativist universe, everybody's their own island. There is no whole. And so we have to start with the fact that there is in human beings, there is a God-shaped vacuum. There's a yearning there. There's a moral law written on our heart. You know, we may be fallen creatures, but God's fingerprints are still all over us. And that's why we know intuitively some things are wrong. We don't have to teach people that child molesters are wrong. People intuitively know this. They know intuitively that murder is wrong. Why? Because of the law written on the heart. And so we start with those kinds of things, and we say, let's talk about the fact that the law of non-contradiction. If something is true, its opposite can't be true. And if you don't accept that, then there is no conversation possible or any dialogue possible between human beings. And there are basically only two answers to the question, who and what is a human being? Either we are a collection of molecules, we're specks of dust blown on the wind of fate, as Bertrand Russell said, and life has absolutely no meaning, no purpose. It's random. It's utterly without meaning. Or human beings were created for a purpose, and there is a purpose and a meaning to life. And you can know that purpose and meaning to life only by knowing the Creator. And the only way you're going to know the Creator is through a personal relationship with His Son.
So I know that at Southern Evangelical Seminary, you are actively seeking to equip your students to engage in this, what I would describe as propositional apologetics. I mean, that's mm-hmm. basically what you're describing. I guess my pushback would be even the New York Times now confesses that there's a truth. And now even the secularists, many of whom are liberal, are saying that the left has more moral authority than the right, and they will lay claim to Jesus, mm-hmm. just not as Savior. So I think that the confusion in our culture runs so much deeper than the starting point of the conversation of whether or not there's truth. Because now we've got the New York Times saying, well, yes, there's truth, and it's never been more important. But how you define that is critical.
Well, my response to that would be the New York Times wouldn't know truth if they fell over it at midday in bright sunlight. I would just go, if somebody said that to me, I would just say what C.S. Lewis said. You can either reject Jesus as the greatest imposter and liar who ever lived, or a lunatic on the level of the man who thinks he's a poached egg, or he's the Son of God. But the one thing you can't say is that he was a great moral teacher, because he didn't leave that option open to us. He claimed to be God. He claimed the prerogatives of God in a culture where claiming the prerogatives of God can get you killed. And he's the only person who ever came back from the dead. And the evidence is compelling. The evidence is overwhelming that there was a resurrection. And the most compelling evidence is psychological. You have more than 100 people who lived lives of extreme privation, who were in many cases tortured to death, were beaten within an inch of their life, and even crucified and boiled in oil. You don't do that for something you know is a lie. And the disciples, if Jesus did not resurrect from the dead, they had to know it was a lie. They lived those lives because he did come back from the dead. And when he came back from the dead, he transformed their lives. There is no logical, rational explanation for the Christian faith other than the disciples were confronted by a miraculous resurrection to life.
So how are you equipping your students at SES to practically articulate that in the world today?
Well, first of all, we want to make sure they understand biblical truth. That's for starters. We are a Thomistic evangelical seminary, maybe the only one in captivity.
You're going to have to define that.
Well, we believe in natural law. We believe in the arguments for the Christian faith from natural law as espoused by Thomas Aquinas. Dr. Norm Geisler founded our seminary 25 years ago. We're in our 25th anniversary year this year. And so it's more than just propositional truth. We believe in natural law. We believe that natural law cannot save you, but a belief in natural law presents a method of argumentation that is very, very difficult for agnostics and atheists and moral relativists to refute. And this is where we start from. And so we teach a lot of theology. We teach a lot of philosophy. You have to have 16 hours of theology and 12 hours of philosophy to get a bachelor's or a master's degree from us. And then we talk about apologetic methods. We have a course in logic, which is unusual in seminaries, but we have a course in logic and a course in rhetoric. And we teach worldly philosophies. We want them to know what these worldly philosophies are, and we want to deconstruct them. And so that our graduates aren't going to hear anything new. They aren't going to hear any arguments they haven't heard.
So folks, let me remind you, we're talking to Dr. Richard Land. He's the president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. He also serves as the executive editor of the Christian Post. You might remember him because of his very great influence in what we would all now call the movement of the religious right. So let's talk about that. You lived it. Mm-hmm. It's your lived reality. So maybe describe to my listeners what your perception of the religious right is, what you all were trying to achieve, and sort of the status of things today.
Well, let me first of all say that I got lumped in with the religious right, and I agree with them on a lot of things. But when I was head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission for 25 years, we spent as much effort and time and money talking about racial reconciliation as we did talking about the pro-life issue. We spent as much time talking about alleviating world hunger as we did the religious freedom issue. So our ministry was, I believe, a little more full-orbed than the religious right. But I applaud them for being right much of the time. The religious right, sort of the coming out party for the religious right, was the National Affairs Briefing in 1980 in Dallas, Texas. I was there. I was covering it for KCBI Radio. I was known as the boy dean at Criswell College. I became dean at 28 at Criswell College and was working with the radio ministry. And that's where Ronald Reagan famously came and said, "Well, I know that you can't endorse me, but I'm here to endorse you." And basically, if you want to know where the religious right came from, I saw it happen. I was a foot soldier in the pro-life army before I was a sergeant and then a commissioned officer. And I saw it happen. Roe v. Wade was judicial imperialism at its worst in 1973. And it did not cause the reaction that became the religious right. What caused it was the bloodshed that came after that. I don't think anybody expected, I don't think even the liberals expected, that the consequence of Roe v. Wade would be that we would go from 400,000 legal abortions a year to 1.5 million in 12 months.
Yeah, it's staggering.
And it was literally the carnage and the slaughter that awakened Southern Baptists and other conservative evangelicals that this was grotesque and it had to stop. And that's when, you know, Jerry Falwell registered 14 million evangelical church members who weren't even registered to vote. And, you know, they, in 1976, Jimmy Carter, running as a Southern Baptist and running against a pro-choice Republican, got 64% of the white Baptist vote. In 1980, Jimmy Carter, running against a pro-life Republican, who, and the Republicans had adopted a pro-life plank in their platform, got Ronald Reagan got 66% of the white Baptist vote. His pollster, Jimmy Carter's pollster, said that that is what elected Gerald Ford. That's what elected Ronald Reagan. It elected Ronald Reagan was that shift, a one-third shift in one election cycle. And actually, I argue that if the Republican Party had not become the pro-life party, that for the second time in our history, a party would have died. The Whig Party died when both the Whig Party and the Democrat Party both tried to be pro-choice on slavery. At some point, anti-slavery sentiment reached critical mass, and the Republican Party replaced the Whig Party. Well, pro-life sentiment had reached critical mass. And if the Republican Party had not adopted a pro-life plank and run a pro-life candidate, the Republican Party would have died, and it would have been replaced by a pro-life party. Most Southern Baptists, for instance, that I know, they grew up with their parents voting Democrat and did not consider themselves Republican, but they voted pro-life. And that was the engine that drove the so-called religious right. Now, prayer in schools and all those other things, you know, let's understand, all of the involvement of the religious right in public policy was defensive. They were trying to defend against secularists and progressiveness who were attacking the status quo. And, you know, the goal was to elect congressmen and senators and others and who would nominate and confirm justices who would rein in judicial imperialism. Mm-hmm. That's what it was about.
So we are, it feels like, at another inflection point in both the Democratic and the Republican parties. They both feel a little bit up for grabs in terms of a defining philosophy, a point of passion, a particular direction in some cases. So I'm just wondering if you'd like to give a little guidance to the next generation, maybe, in terms of... if you really do want to bring the Christian faith to bear in the public square...
Well, I would say, first of all, that your ultimate allegiance does not belong to any political party. You know, our ultimate allegiance belongs to Jesus Christ, not to any political party. Political parties are not going to be any better than you insist that they be. Political parties are human organizations that are organized to get more votes than their opponents so they can exercise power. And so they will manipulate you if you let them. They will exploit you if you let them. And I said on many occasions that one of my goals was to keep the Republican Party from treating evangelicals the way the Democrat Party treated blacks. The Democrat Party took blacks for granted, and they showed up at election time, and they didn't do much for them after that. And they took them for granted. And I didn't want Republicans to take the evangelical vote for granted, that, you know, if they want our votes, they need to come ask for it, and that we should not be endorsing candidates. We should be looking for candidates who endorse us, as Ronald Reagan did in 1980. We are living through a time of profound political change. That's the second time in my lifetime that's happened. I'm 70 years old. I'm the same age as Donald Trump. And by the way, just a bit of trivia for your listeners, we now have three presidents who were born in one summer. In June of 1946, Donald Trump was born. In July of 1946, George W. Bush was born. And in August of 1946, Bill Clinton was born. So there must have been something in the water that summer. I mean, that's never happened before. But I saw the Goldwater Revolution take the Republican Party from being the party of the Eastern establishment to being the party of the Sun Belt and the West. And then I saw George McGovern take over the Democrat Party and make it the party of the hard left. And chase away. My dad was always a Democrat till the day he died. He said, I didn't leave my party left me. And they became much more like European parties. Up until then, whether you were Republican or Democrat depended a lot more on where you lived and what your socioeconomic status was. That's socioeconomic status is a really lousy indicator today of which party you belong to. You're far more likely to find out what party a person belongs to if you ask them, do you go to worship services more than once a week? If you do, 2/3 of you are Republicans. If you seldom or never go to worship services, you are 3 times as likely to be a Democrat. If you're a married woman, you are more likely to be a Republican. If you're a single woman, 2 out of 3 single women in this country are Democrats. Married couples with children, 60% of them vote Republican, 40% vote Democrat. Those are far more reliable things. And that has to do with worldview and with a lot of different things. Now, Bill Clinton tried to pull the Democrat Party back from the McGovern Heights. He founded the Democratic Leadership Council. And, you know, he was the most concerned. The two Democrats that have won before Obama were the most conservative guys running as Democrats. Carter, it's hard to believe, but Carter was the most conservative Democrat running. And Bill Clinton was the most conservative Democrat running. Barack Obama is the first president Democrats have had since Lyndon Johnson that they actually liked, that actually shared their philosophy. I wrote an article in the Christian Post in which I took a little bit of issue with Dennis Prager, who I always do that with a great deal of trepidation because Dennis is a very smart fellow. But he said that what we were experiencing in America was a second civil war. It's really more like the second American Revolution. And Barack Obama attempted a secular progressive revolution in America, and he pushed the country so far that the reaction was Donald Trump. And what Donald Trump is a counter-revolution. And I think that both the Republican establishment and the Democrat establishment don't realize that their present is now the past. And we're in uncharted territory now. And both parties are up for grabs. Both parties are up for grabs. And the Democrats seem to have not come to grips with the new reality yet. And a lot of the Republican establishment hasn't come to grips with reality yet. I mean, a lot of Republicans who are still stunned that Donald Trump won.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to have to leave it right there, but I'm glad that in a culture that is adrift and in a time of uncharted territory politically, we have an anchor that holds.
We do, and I would say to Christians, do your best to be salt and light in both parties and in the country. Let them compete for being the most biblical in their responses and critique both parties when they're wrong and applaud both parties when they're right.
Dr. Land, thank you so much for being with us today on The Reconnect.
Thank you.
All right, folks. So you know that I wholeheartedly agree with where we left that conversation at the end. I absolutely think that you got to get out there with your biblical worldview and you got to let the truth that God presents compete in the marketplace of ideas. And where one party is right and righteous, we've got to applaud. And where a party of whatever variety is wrong and unrighteous, we are obligated to confront it. So appreciate Dr. Land's certainly service to the church and his perspective shared here today. Okay, it's time to go below the fold. This is the time in the show where we like to lift up stories and make connections that, you know, they certainly don't initially appear to be about God, but where we are trying to weave that eternal principle into the conversation with the goal not only of maybe changing the course of a conversation, but the course of another person's thinking and living. So you might remember that we've been talking last summer about the Zika virus. We talked this early last summer about these babies that were being born in Brazil with microcephaly, which is the condition that results in them having a very small head. These babies were not expected to live very long. There's now renewed hope among the community of people who are raising these children with microcephaly. Apparently, a malaria drug is proving quite effective, not only in treatment, but in early intervention. So when we talk about kids at risk around the world, I want to lift up to you not only our ongoing care and concern and prayers for the situation of Charlie Gard in the UK, remembering that his parents have until today to produce information and evidence that the court might find compelling to that would result in possibly their child being allowed to travel here to the United States for an experimental treatment that one doctor says holds out to 10% hope of some kind of help for Charlie Gard. If you are on social media, you know that, you know, the hashtag pray for Charlie, the hashtag save Charlie. I mean, there's all kinds of hashtags out there related to this baby. You know, there's all kinds of fundraising efforts. There's all kinds of non-governmental organizations raising money around the desperation of this child and his family. All of that should raise some level of concern for us. But this is really a pro-life conversation that we have got to learn how to have. Because we are very disturbed by this one situation of this one child with what for all the world appears to be an irreversible genetic disorder that is terminal. And as grievous as that is, there are literally millions of children around the globe who are dying of absolutely 100% preventable, treatable diseases, disorders, and things, well, as simple and complicated as malnutrition. So the story I want to lift up to you today is one about an act of the United Nations in relationship to the country of Yemen. So there was a plan put in place a month ago to ship 1 million cholera vaccines to Yemen. Why? Well, there are 313,000 suspected cases of cholera. They've already experienced 1,700 deaths in the past 2 months. We're talking about a conflict zone that has left 14.5 million people without access to clean drinking water or sanitation. When you don't have access to clean drinking water or sanitation, cholera becomes a problem. Cholera is both preventable and it is treatable. However, in order to prevent it, you have to have the vaccine, which comes in two doses and has to be kept refrigerated in between. And that's difficult to achieve in a conflict zone. But you also, you can prevent it. You can prevent it. You can treat it. In order to treat it, you have to have clean water, which they don't have. And you have to have a sanitation system in place, which they also don't have. So when we talk about our ability to intervene in situations and save the lives of children, we got 24 million kids at risk in the Middle East, based on UNICEF numbers. 1.4 million kids in Africa at imminent risk of starvation. Nearly 6 million kids under the age of 5 died in 2015 from preventable, treatable issues like diarrhea and malaria. Folks, those are affordable interventions. All right, I'm just trying to lift your awareness and give us some perspective on what's going on in the world today and what we could do in addition to pray about it, and that is to intervene. Hey, this is The Reconnect. We are completely out of time. Visit me at reconnectwithcarmen.com, and I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.